You're listening to the aria of Don Alviera, Mitradi Qual'alma Ingrata, and Mozart's Don Giovanni. It is the Open House Zürich 2001 production, directed by Jürgen Flimm. The chorus and orchestra are conducted by Nicholas Harnoncourt, a descendant of the Holy Roman Emperors, and a talent potent enough to leave his position as a cellist with the Vienna Symphony to make his conducting debut at no less a venue than La Scala in 1970. Perhaps unusually, it is a mezzo-soprano, Cecilia Bartoli, playing the part of Donna Elvira. But, to my way of thinking, it is the combination of her performance and Harnoncourt's conducting that makes this production one of the most compelling of Mozart recordings. Betrayed by Don Giovanni, a knavish and misogynistic nobleman, Donna Elvira swears revenge and spends the production trying, mostly in vain, to convince the various other players in the drama of Don Giovanni's evil ways. Her warnings are prescient, of course, but as the drama ends, and though Don Giovanni is dragged to the underworld by demons, Donna Elvira's fate seems more than a little unjust. She withdraws from society to live in exile for the remainder of her life. If her ignoble end sounds familiar, it might be because it mirrors the fate of so many female characters and anti-heroines in history and literature. But to focus on the particular young woman of interest to me at present, one must close one's eyes and strain to perceive her particular and rather peculiar voice, or, at least, faintest of its echoes. They are reverberations attenuated over more than two millennia. They are the last remnants of utterances that the many louder histories of her contemporaries threatened to drown out. Together, they populate an era I feel I must contextualize first, an era that would change the course of the ancient world. The last collective gasps of the Roman Republic. I'm Isabella Valeri, and this is Whispers from the Dead. Shocked by the quick advance of Julius Caesar on Rome, on 17 January 49 BC, Pompey Magnus declared himself unable to defend the city. Seven of Pompey's legions were in Spain, leaving only two in Italy, and those newly formed in green. Caesar's unexpected move and the speed with which he executed it, a characteristic of his command that had yielded such success in the Gallic War, caused a huge stir in Rome. Her citizens remembered well, and with horror, the purges and proscriptions carried out by Sulla some 30 years earlier, and feared Caesar and his legions easily capable of similar acts. These were the opening moves of what would later be called Caesar's Civil War, and a bit of essential background to the characters who play later roles in the grand drama that unfolds, as the fate of Rome is decided, and with it, the fate of the young woman who, today, whispers to us from among the dead. In actuality, Caesar had left eight legions, the bulk of his forces, north of the Alps in their winter camps in Gaul, and two near Narbonne in present-day France to guard against any effort by Pompey's Spanish legions to threaten Caesar's western flank. Caesar was marching on Rome with a single legion, Legio 13, But this was not common knowledge, and no one in Rome could be quite sure how many forces were thrusting southward. In the absence of real news, the rumours were as plentiful as they were dire. It followed that, on the 17th and 18th of January, Pompey and most of the Senate and magistrates fled the city for the south. Pompey had superior naval forces and knew that his influence in the east meant he could raise twice Caesar's force there and then pinch the upstart rebel between these new legions and Pompey's existing troops in Spain. Once Pompey had abandoned Italy for Macedonia, it was these Spanish legions that Caesar attacked first, defeating them and subduing the Spanish provinces as well as Sicily, Corsica, and Sardinia. But Pompey had nearly a year in Macedonia to prepare, and had by that time fielded a substantial army with which he intended to invade Italy. Before he had the chance, Caesar landed his troops in present-day Albania, but after Caesar suffered an initial defeat, Pompey was happy to wear down the thinner forces of his foe via attrition. Though he refused battle at every turn, in the background, the senators and magistrates in Pompey's war council urged him repeatedly to use his superior numbers to crush Caesar. Pompey knew that Caesar fought differently from many Roman commanders, that he preferred to travel light and fast and, even if it should mean they were under strength, form his mobile legions with the very best and most experienced troops. Many had been battle-hardened in the crucible of Gaul. Pompey's Macedonian legions, on the other hand, had been recently raised. This made Caesar dangerous, even when outnumbered. Nevertheless, eventually, the many voices braying for Caesar's blood prevailed. Finally, by then reinforced with two additional legions from Syria, Pompey deigned to offer battle near Pharsalus. There, Caesar's 8 understrength legions on some 1,000 head of cavalry faced 45,000 of Pompey's troops and more than 5,000 cavalry. Caesar was outnumbered 2-1 in infantry and 5 or even 7-1 in cavalry. Mark Antony led the legions on Caesar's far left flank. But when Caesar saw Pompey's cavalry massed to his right, he understood his enemy's intentions in an instant. Pompey intended to whip his mounted troops around Caesar's lines. In response, Caesar stripped down his third line, where Roman legions traditionally arrayed their best troops, to create a hidden fourth line. These he instructed to mass just behind his right flank on parallax to the main lines to counter the cavalry danger. They were also to ignore the usual Roman tactic of throwing their pilums, the 2-meter-long javelins carried by Roman infantry, before charging. Instead, this fourth line was to stand its ground against Pompey's cavalry, stabbing at the faces of Pompey's mounted troops. The novel tactic worked. After routing Caesar's own outnumbered horse, Pompey's cavalry met Caesar's hidden fourth line, reared up and baroque. They were never able to truly reform, allowing Caesar's fourth line, as well as his 10th legion, first to flank. And then, once Pompey's unprotected missile troops on Caesar's right flank were cut down, to roll up Pompey's lines from the left flank, wheeling about and attacking Pompey's already engaged infantry from the rear. Pompey himself had taken the field on the left, behind his favored 1st and 3rd legions. Once he saw his mounted troops in disarray and his infantry beginning to rout immediately in front of him, he fled the battlefield. Caesar's speed forced the next issue. Pompey was in the midst of preparing retreat from his camp in the rear when he was warned that Caesar's forces were advancing on the position. Pompey tore off his commander's robe, donned civilian clothing, and fled with as much gold as he could carry, leaving his troops to fend for themselves. When Caesar arrived in Pompey's camp, he found it lavish beyond all reason. Further, correspondence and writings recovered from Pompey's headquarters tent made it obvious that Pompey, the Senate, and the magistrates had been so confident in victory that they had already begun dividing the spoils they expected to recover. including a schedule of those who would be elected consul of Rome for years to come, those supporters of Caesar who would be killed and the properties seized, and a long list of Caesar's holdings and the manner in which they would be divided amongst them. Instead, and though Pompey had not given up, the Battle of Pharsalus had effectively decided Caesar's civil war. Most of Pompey's eastern supporters and allies had been killed or captured by Caesar's forces in the Battle of Pharsalus, but Ptolemy XIII, the 14-year-old pharaoh of Egypt, had not been present. Pompey announced his intention to retreat to Africa and continue the fight from there. Unfortunately, most of the senators and magistrates who had followed him during his flight from Rome and the Italian peninsula had lost all taste for battle. Cicero abandoned Pompey's cause and returned to Italy. And Brutus would later surrender to Caesar, whose reputation for mercy had been carefully cultivated throughout his civil war. In fact, after seizing Pompey's camp, Caesar burned most of Pompey's correspondence so that no evidence could later be used to legally prosecute his routed foe. And so, in much reduced circumstances, Pompey absconded first to Cyprus and then, on 28 September 48 BC, to Pelusium, near the Nile Delta. With the delegation that met him, Pompey saw a familiar face, Lucius Septimius, who had served under Pompey during his eastern campaign more than a decade earlier. Comforted by the presence of an old friend, Pompey must have let down his guard. Right before Lucius Septimius ran him through and killed him, as his wife and children watched in horror. Caesar arrived only days later and was furious with Ptolemy XIII, who had tried to curry favor with Caesar by having Pompey murdered. The Ptolemies were not Egyptian, but rather Macedonian Greek, that dynasty having been founded by one of Alexander's generals who just happened to have been governing Egypt when Alexander died. Assuming the sty of Ptolemy I, he was, by all accounts, a consummate scholar and eventually founded the Great Library of Alexandria. By the 13th generation of his dynasty, however, the Ptolemies had adopted the Egyptian practice of sibling marriage, whereby the throne passed to the eldest brother and eldest sister, who were expected to rule and live thereafter as husband and wife. Palace intrigue and successions had become notoriously bitter and bloody affairs, and on his arrival, Caesar found himself in the middle of just such a spat between the 14-year-old Ptolemy XIII and his sister, the 21-year-old Cleopatra VII. Ptolemy had driven Cleopatra into exile, though she had rallied Syrian support to her cause and threatened to invade to claim the throne, putting Caesar in the position of resolving the conflict or leaving Egypt, a critical source of grain for Rome in turmoil. Famously, Cleopatra had herself smuggled into the palace in Alexandria in a carpet bag, where she greeted and charmed Caesar to her cause. Ptolemy was horrified and did his best to stir the population against the Romans, resulting in a months-long siege of the city of Alexandria and the palace that saw Caesar's men badly outnumbered and barely able to resist the forces of Achillas, the scheming head of the army and longtime advisor to Ptolemy. In the initial fray, Caesar ordered the ships in the harbour set alight, prompting the famous fire that, some scholars insist, consumed, or at least damaged, the great library of Alexandria. It is in the aftermath of this engagement that we come to the story of immediate interest. Caesar had seized Ptolemy after the young figurehead had declared himself against the Romans and held him prisoner in the palace. Caesar seems, however, to have underestimated another member of the dynasty, one who would cause him no end of grief. Somehow, Ptolemy's sister escaped the Roman-occupied palace and fled into the desert. Not Cleopatra, of course, but rather her younger half-sister, Arsinoe, either the third or fourth daughter of Ptolemy XII. Once at liberty, Arsinoe declared herself Arsinoe IV, Queen of Egypt, and join Achillas to lead what had been Ptolemy's army against the Romans. Depending on the historian one consults, the queen was as young as 15 or as old as 17 at the time. Caesar's forces worked to fortify their quarter of Alexandria and the palace, but now under the command of Arsinoe with Achilles as her second, the Egyptians levied troops, built siege works, armed the male slaves to patrol the streets against Roman expeditions beyond the palace, blocked the streets and alleyways, and even built great wooden structures set on wheels to create mobile watchtowers they could drag to any point to bolster defences with elevated missile troops. It is tempting to attribute these tactics of ancient warfare solely to Achillas, who, as the head of the army, must have been familiar with such matters. But Arsinoe had more insidious designs. In an effort to win the personal loyalty of the army fighting in her name, she promised lavish inducements and bounties, gestures Achillas had to repeatedly outdo to maintain his grip on power. It did not avail him, and, in a rather Machiavellian bit of business, Arsinoe had him assassinated by her tutor, the eunuch Ganymede, who thereby became her most trusted counselor. In total command of the army, Arsinoe intensified her efforts against the Romans. Her army rerouted seawater into the aqueducts servicing the quarter of Alexandria occupied by Caesar and his legions, making their water supplies undrinkable and nearly causing a panic among his troops. Caesar seriously considered withdrawing from the city before an engineering solution was arrived at. Furiously, the Romans dug new wells, saved by Caesar's realization that Alexandria had been built atop porous limestone. Arsinoe's forces would later inflict a serious defeat on Caesar's troops during the battle for Pharos Island. There, Caesar lost over 800 men, losses they could ill afford so far away from Rome. The situation was desperate enough that, at one point, Caesar had to throw off his armor and swim to shore, leaving his purple commander's cloak floating in the water, a trophy Arsinoe recovered and proudly flew from the lighthouse at Pharos as a sign of her victory. As the conflict wore on, and better able to conduct warfare by sea, Arsinoe's army repeatedly forced naval clashes, a distinct weakness of Caesar's. It was a bit of intrigue that seems finally to have broken the stalemate. Secretly, the Alexandrians sent a delegation to Caesar asking him to return to them their king, the young Ptolemy. Some members of the army, still loyal to the memory of their slain commander Achillas, had taken a scheming against the young queen that led them. Though Caesar made a fine speech to the boy, as if to convince him to appeal to the army to come to terms with the Romans, it seemed more likely that he did so for appearance's sake. In fact, Caesar recognized that introducing a rival to Arsinoe's claim to the throne might sow chaos into the ranks of his opponents. Sure enough, no sooner had Ptolemy joined the army than he declared against Caesar and spurred a contest with his sister for power. The fortunes of the Alexandrian army waned after that until, in 47 BC, Caesar won a decisive victory against them during the Battle of the Nile. The young king, Ptolemy XIII, drowned when, trying to flee in an overloaded warship, the vessel capsized. Caesar seized Arsinoe as his prisoner, installed the 12-year-old Ptolemy XIV as king of Egypt with Cleopatra as his queen, and, famously, celebrated his conquest of Egypt by absconding with Cleopatra to tour the Nile for nearly 2 months. Some 9 months later, the Egyptian queen gave birth to Caesarion, destined to be the last pharaoh of Ptolemaic Egypt, ruling until age 17 when, in 30 BC, he was murdered by Octavian. At long last, Egypt had been fully annexed into the Roman Republic. Only 3 years before, the Republic itself was finally extinguished when Octavian was transformed into Caesar Augustus, the first Roman emperor. But my thoughts drift back to Arsinoe, and to the notion that adolescence in the ancient world, particularly for the issue of the direct line of a ruling dynasty, was a much different thing. Surely, even today, the children of the wealthy and powerful have childhoods that scarcely resemble the formative years of the rest of the population. But to be the daughter, potentially even the youngest daughter, of Ptolemy the 12th, must have been something else entirely. The Egyptian style of succession adopted by the Ptolemies anticipated the role of daughters of the line. In fact, of Ptolemy the 12th's daughters, all three assumed the title Queen of Egypt at one time or another, on two, Berenice the 4th and Arsinoe, only had their claims extinguished by force of arms. And the third, Cleopatra, managed to outwit or entice, either by intrigue or seduction, almost all of her rivals, including, though it cost her her life in the end, Octavian. Of Arsinoe, one must wonder, what could account for the military competency, not to mention the ravenous ambition, of a 15-year-old girl of that era? At age 12, could she be found kneeling over a sandbox on the palace floor, moving towards soldiers over a facsimile of desert stands, her eunuch tutor Ganymede lecturing to her on the importance of unit cohesion, protecting one's flanks on the Roman style of land warfare? Would she be visited by engineers of the ancient world to be schooled on the nature and capabilities of various engines of siege? She might have been 8 or 9 in 55 BC, when her father was restored to the Egyptian throne and, having defeated his eldest daughter, Berenice the 4th, on later executing her, set into the line of succession Arsinoe's siblings Cleopatra and Ptolemy. One might almost picture her hiding in the shadows as her father took his war council, listening, marking his words and the deeds that followed them. But even if not, certainly she, as her sisters, must have taken example from watching the results of her father's ruthless tactics of intrigue. Alas, it did not avail her in the end. Caesar shipped Arsinoe to Rome in chains, where she was destined to be paraded in his unprecedented quadruple triumph, intended to celebrate his victories in Gaul, Pontus, Africa, and Egypt. It was well known that prominent prisoners such as an upstart Queen of Egypt would be publicly strangled at the end of a triumph. It was the fear of this ignominy that seems to have induced Cleopatra to take her own life rather than attend Rome as Octavian's guest. And indeed, this was the actual fate of Vercingetorix, the vanquished Gallic king Caesar had held imprisoned in the Tullianum for 6 years so that he could be ritualistically murdered at the very same quadruple triumph. And so, in April of 46 BC, Arsinoe was paraded behind a burning effigy of the lighthouse from which she had once hung Caesar's purple cloak. But then something unusual happened. The figure of the young woman in chains, tears streaming down her face, elicited such sympathy from the Roman crowds that Caesar was persuaded to spare her. Instead, he granted her sanctuary, guaranteed by the goddess Artemis at her temple in Ephesus. As a pardon, it was quite a grant. The Temple of Artemis, located in present-day Turkey, was one of the 7 wonders of the world, and Artemis herself was the goddess of the hunt, the care of children, and virgins. Given the ancient regard for such religious matters, Arsinoe must have been greatly relieved. And so we come full circle. As the fates of Don Elvira and Arsinoe merge, a quiet exile, removed from society. But unfortunately, Arsinoe's fate would be less sanguine. By all accounts, she lived in the temple quietly, respecting the terms of her parole, until, in 41 BC, only 3 years after the assassination of Caesar, Mark Antony ordered her murdered on the temple steps, apparently at the urging of Cleopatra. The assassination was a gross violation of the sanctity of the temple and scandalized Rome. But Anthony would shake off the stain to his reputation, only finally meeting his fate 10 years later when he took his own life in Egypt, followed hard upon by his lover and queen, Cleopatra. Octavian had captured Alexandria from Antony and Cleopatra in 30 BC and murdered Caesarion shortly thereafter. The Ptolemy line and all three of Ptolemy the XII's singular daughters were extinguished. With them, the Roman Republic, as Octavian was thereafter sole ruler of Rome, and in 27 BC would become Caesar Augustus and emperor. In the 1900s, a strange monument in Ephesus was discovered by a member of the Austrian Academy of Sciences. It bore no inscription, but in 1926, the skeleton of a young woman between the ages of 15 and 18 was discovered in a burial chamber. After much excitement that the remains might have been those of the murdered Arsinoe, and therefore the only remains of any member of the Ptolemy dynasty ever recovered. Alas, in 2017, DNA testing proved inconclusive, and all other efforts to connect the bones with Arsinoe came to naught. Of the remarkable adolescent queen, we have nothing, only her whispers from the dead.